Pentagon officials confirmed yesterday that 5,600 ready reservists will be called up. One of the reasons an unnamed Pentagon source gave for calling on ready reservists is that we are at war. We're going to talk about what a ready reservist is, why they're needed, and what sense Americans have about being at war. Join the conversation. Are you or someone in your family affected by the call for ready reservists or stop loss efforts? Do you or your community have a sense that the country's at war? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from his home in Arlington, Virginia, is Dan Gouray. He's vice president of the Lexington Institute, which is a public policy research organization based in Arlington. And Dan Gouray, good to have you back on Talk of the Nation. And is that Dan Gouray's telephone line going kerplunk? Well, in any case, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, if you'd like to get in on the conversation, or you can call us, you can email us, totn@npr.org. And, of course, in addition to the ready reserves, we're also going to be talking about the situation of people already in uniform who were scheduled to either transfer out of units headed for Iraq or Afghanistan, or scheduled to leave the military for one reason or another. Stop-loss orders have prevented them from doing so. And I think Dan Gouray is now on the line with us from his home in Arlington, Virginia. Good to speak with you again, Dan.
Thank you very much.
Remind us, what's a ready reservist?
Well, the individual ready reserve is a subcomponent of the overall selected reserve. Those are people who are not associated with a particular unit, but are in the reserve as essentially individuals. They're usually retired or, in effect, not in the military except in nominal reserve status. They don't have to train with a unit the way a regular National Guardsman does, but they're still subject to recall if we need their specialties.
And again, this is a question of specialties, is it not?
Yes, it is. These are people who, by and large, have special skills. So there's an arrangement between the government, if you will, the Department of Defense, and the military and the individual, so that that individual can complete their service obligation, get retirement if they're going for their 20 or 30 year, and at the same time, be potentially callable if there's a need.
Now, the specialties that are needed are, civil affairs, intelligence, that sort of thing?
That's right. These are what you might call high demand, low density, that is low numbers overall in the military. And as a result, they are in short supply, particularly for a situation like Iraq. So we're looking to get more of them into the units that are going into combat.
This doesn't happen often, but did happen, in the first Gulf War?
That's right. We recalled about 20,000 of the individual ready reserve in addition to guard units at the time of Desert Storm.
Okay. It gets to the question that should the administration, before this war in Iraq got underway, have increased or made some decisions to increase the size of the forces?
Well, there's been sort of an argument going on nationally, actually, for several years, but now in the Congress, in the House and the Senate, both have argued in the defense bills to increase the size of the Army, and the House has actually the Marine Corps, by between 20 and 30-some thousand.
Okay, let's get some listeners involved in this conversation. 800-989-8255. Lewis is with us from Vineland, New Jersey.
Hello?
Lewis, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. My comment was that I'm not a veteran of the previous war, or the war that we're in right now. I was in the First Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
And had 30 days approximately due to get out of the military, and was told I was not leaving.
Stop loss.
Well, they called it involuntary extension back then.
I see. They've changed the terminology.
Yeah, under George Bush the First, it was involuntary extension, meaning you were extended from anywhere from 6 months to a year.
And how did you take it when that decision was handed to you?
Well, anyone that's looking to get out of the military looks for a job prior to getting out. And I was due to go into the police academy, and I had to watch that day come and go as I sat in Saudi Arabia.
And Dan Gouray, there's an awful lot of people's lives who are being disrupted.
Look, there's no question about this. This is not a choice that the military makes easily, for the very obvious reason that it disrupts people's lives. It is not one that it likes to do, but under conditions of major conflict or major operations, it's hard to see how you can do anything else and still make the maximum effort needed to protect your forces and to see the result that you want, at the end.
Lewis, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Prior to that happening, they were letting people out of the military in droves, early outs and everything. And then when the Gulf War came along, all that was suddenly automatically changed.
Yeah. In the end of the day, did you, first of all, did you feel like your service was worthwhile? And B, when you did get out of the service, were you able to make yourself whole and get into the police academy?
I was able to continue on, but it was a delay that made an impact on my family and really was, it set me back several years.
And did you feel that you were being unfairly asked to for this sacrifice?
I joined up full well knowing that I was going to do whatever I had to do, but this was coming on the heels of Just Cause, going to war after the invasion of Panama, and then we're going to another country. It just seemed like it was a little too much to ask of someone who did their time and was ready to say, I've done enough.
Okay, Lewis, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And let's get another caller on the line. This is Tricia. Tricia's on the road in Wyoming.
Yeah, kind of like the last guy said, when you join the military, you know that you have 30 years of obligation, one way or the other, active, inactive reserves, or like the Navy calls it, fleet reserve.
Mm-hmm.
We were affected by stop loss like three times. Once in 91, my husband was due to retire. And then the Navy's always called it stop loss, by the way.
Uh-huh.
As far as I know, in 91, they were calling it stop loss on our base because they don't like the word involuntary. But it's not like a draft. You know when you go into it, if you don't want to take that risk, don't join the military. I mean, it's not like they put a gun at your head and had you sign the contract. They explained it quite well.
We're having a little trouble with your cell phone, Tricia. But I just wanted to ask, you were talking about... And your daughter wants to get in on the conversation as well.
No, my son is afraid to sit in a car by himself.
Oh, I see. But was your husband was in the service at the time? Were you as well?
No, sir. No, I was the one stuck at home with the five kids with chickenpox.
Oh, so you were the one making the sacrifice.
You know, but he's been to the Persian Gulf, like, back when the Marine barracks were bombed. They couldn't get out. And they couldn't come home. And then in 91, they couldn't come home. When the Stark got blown up, they couldn't come home. And that was Iraq, too, if you remember.
I do.
And, I mean, it's just, you know when you join the military, they explain, at least they did when I was in delayed entry. It's big, big letters on the contract. And you sign a contract. So these people say, well, I joined for college, not to fight. Well, you joined the military, not the Glee Club.
Mm. Dan Garay, that's made pretty clear to people.
Oh, look, it's absolutely made clear, all the obligations. And, of course, there's even some extensions when you become an officer. So it's not that this is illegal or even that people have signed contracts without being informed. Nonetheless, you know, it still is a hardship. And there's just no question about it.
Tricia, thanks very much for the phone call. And I hope you get back in the car and make your son feel better.
Thank you. But I never said it wasn't a hardship. It's just you know to expect it.
You know to expect it. Well, you know, in a way, you know, some people, and obviously those in the military, yes, they sign these contracts, but they're asked to, when push comes to shove, they're asked to sacrifice more than others, them and their family members.
I don't know, he's been retired 2 years, and he just got told to be prepared to be called, so.
There you go again.
That's 20 years, and I'm sorry, he knew it when he joined it, and we make more money as civilians, and I really don't want to be left in nowhere, Wyoming, while he's out to sea.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We're talking about the decision of the Pentagon to call up 5,600 members of the Ready Reserve and many others who have been informed of stop-loss orders that they will not be allowed to depart from the military at this particular time. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And now let's take a call from Ramon. Ramon is on the line with us from Fort Lauderdale.
Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I don't know if a few comments. I was listening to Trish, and although I somewhat agree, I have to flip the coin a little bit because I believe the majority, the makeup of the military has a lot with a lot of minorities that are involved where there are no real opportunities. And those opportunities are presented with the military, and you see it on commercials all the time. And in Spanish, they have, Yo soy el Army. I'm the Army, translated into English. And then they pull these people up from the lowest income brackets, I believe, if all the reports that I've been hearing are correct. And then to say that after you volunteer, we're going to keep you. It's, to me, it just seems like an involuntary draft. Once you're in, we got you by the claws. And although it is true you did volunteer, I don't think a lot of them didn't expect that. They go in to get an education, to learn things, to and of course, let's not forget the patriotism that's involved. But I think it's just totally wrong the way we're doing things right now, especially with the war on terror, that we're all consistently hearing that this war is going to last many, 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 many years. And if it's going to last many, 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 many years, I think this draft should be instituted. And let's bring everybody from all the socioeconomic strata that we have here in the United States involved in this process, and not just the ones that need an education or need a hand up to get out from whatever situation that they're currently in.
Ramon,
my comment.
Did you serve in the armed forces, Ramon?
Yes, I did. But I served in the 70s.
When there was a draft.
When there was a draft. But I was not drafted. I did volunteer. And I did my 3 years, and I left. And that comment from Trish, she said, well, you're in it for 30 years. I could still be called now.
Mm-hmm.
Although I was an 11B, a grunt, an infantryman.
So your specialty may not be in particular demand.
Yeah, perhaps not.
Dan Garay, let me ask you, Ramon is not the first person to describe a stop loss in these call-ups as a sort of a de facto draft.
Well, it is certainly not volunteerism in the sense that we commonly associate it with the all-volunteer Army, but it is not a draft. It is not taking people involuntarily, and it is not taking people without their knowledge. And moreover, most of the people who are in the military are not from the lowest socioeconomic groups. The majority are high school graduates. They are, in effect, middle class, or certainly working class in a broad sense. And it's, I think, unfair to them to characterize them somehow as being so desperate that they'll sign anything and do anything and would be duped into joining the military. Certainly those that are in there in the last decade or so, and it's been a demand for workers, are truly there voluntarily, not because it was the only job they could get.
Ramon?
I'd have to politely disagree and to say that, yeah, they all have high school educations. Well, that's just well and fine, but a high school education today is not worth what it was X amount of years ago. Today you can't get a job even if you have your bachelor's degree, which I do have, fortunately. So a high school diploma doesn't really mean too much. Especially if you're a high school student, you had a difficult time in high school and you're just dreading the idea that if you want a decent job and an education and want to travel and go around the world and become a globetrotter with the military, that's a lot more attractive than spending 4 years at the University of Miami.
Ramon, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And Dan Garay, before we leave you, is there anything the military can do in terms of the people who are being called up to make this a little easier in terms of requiring employers to hold jobs open, that sort of thing?
Well, there is a certain right they have a right of return for a certain period of time. But clearly, it's very hard, for example, to make it financially equal for these people, and it's hard to see how we could do that without raising the defense budget. The only answer long term, if this is in fact going to be something where we need these people over and over again, is to see an expansion of the active military to cover these kind of slots, so there's less chance, except for major war, that the ready reserve will be called up.
And again, that's in discussion in Congress, but it's an election year and not likely to be voted on.
Absolutely.
Dan Garay, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Dan Garay is vice president of the Lexington Institute, which is a public policy research organization based in Arlington, Virginia. And as you heard, he joined us by cell phone from his home in Arlington. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.